Over the past few weeks, I've been asking a lot of questions at the beginning of our shows. How you feel about the economy, your own economic lives, your place in kind of how things are right now. We've done that on a micro scale with individuals, and then we did it on a macro scale across Marketplace in the past several weeks by conducting our first poll. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Today, we're doing answers, both big and little. The middle-of-the-night stuff I asked about last week, you know, what keeps you up at night, and the hopes and dreams stuff that, it turns out, a lot of us still believe in. Keep telling us what you think, feel, and what questions you have on Facebook, Twitter, we're at Marketplace, WKND, and on our website, marketplaceweekend.org. So a poll, yes, is rigorous and methodical, and we'll get to that in a moment. But at its heart, the purpose is about reflecting what people are going through, mirroring our experiences back to us. And one thing we heard is that people are losing sleep worrying about money. Here are a few of them.
My name is Natasha Hopkins. I am 36 years old, and I am originally from New York City. Coming out of school and, you know, having debt that I knew I couldn't afford to pay for, starting entry level, and that right there is the hard piece. So I did lose a little bit of sleep, but, you know, I overcame it, and I think a lot of Americans now, you know, are realizing the same thing.
I'm Dr. James Coleman. I'm pastor of All Nations Baptist Church. We've got to put in a 30,000 plus boiler that just went out in this church. We've got to paint and fix up the church, and we got an estimate $12,000 to $15,000. And the people that I have as parishioners often come from economic status and standing where they can't even get minimum wage. And so my struggle often is I forego my allowance so that we can meet some of the needs. People have heat. And it's not the building, but it is a site where people can come to get hope. And as long as we can keep hope alive, I think the money will come.
My name is Josh Anderson. I'm 33 years old, and I work in communications in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I don't know if concern about my financial situation ever causes me to lose sleep, but it definitely is a worry of mine. Both my wife and I have substantial student loan debt. We have a 9-month-old baby, and so things are expensive. Daycare is expensive, payments are expensive, and those types of bills are preventing us from purchasing our first home.
We set out to collect those voices because of responses we got to our Marketplace Edison Research poll. And no, this is not about the presidential horse race or the debate you may have watched this past week, but rather how we as Americans feel about an economy that is recovering and yet doesn't always seem that way. Here to break it down for us is our Washington Bureau Chief, Dave Shaw. It's good to have you back.
Thank you so much.
Run me through the top line in this poll, but you set it up for me as sort of a story of contradictions here. The first part being hard work versus luck. What did you mean by that?
Right. So there are contradictions all over this. And I think you sort of feel that, you know, you feel that in the economy every day. And what the poll does is it sort of bears some of that stuff out. And so the in terms of the top lines, right, of the more than 1,000 people who we asked about their personal financial situations, there was a really great question in there we asked about, do you think hard work or luck is more salient in achieving what it is that you want to achieve? And there was a vast majority, nearly 80%, who said, hard work, that's what's going to get me what I want. You know, when it comes to, you know, being the biggest factor in a person's financial situation. When you do a poll like this, it's rare to see such a majority come down on a question with more than, you know, more than one answer.
So they believe in themselves, but there's still this sense that they're anxious, they're nervous. And what did you find in terms of what makes people so nervous, and who, I guess, is the most anxious? Because we sort of created this
index of anxiety, if you will.
Yeah, that's the big feature of this poll, and that's going to be this piece that we're able to come back to time and time again to trace how people are feeling. Basically, you know, there's 50-some-odd questions that are in this survey that we did. And when we took the answers to a dozen of those questions that relate to a person's financial security, job prospects, and sort of monthly stress level when it comes to paying bills and setting aside money for things that are important, like retirement or college savings, that sort of thing. And depending on how a person answers those 12 questions, we arrive at a number. 0 to 100, and the higher the number is on that scale, the more stressed out the person is. We call it the economic anxiety index. And so the mean score overall is 31. That'll be useful to track through time. What's immediately interesting is to look at how different subgroups compare. Younger people are feeling more economic anxiety than our older people. However, and this gets to the contradiction, this is what's so interesting, is that some of the younger groups tend to be the most hopeful about how things might improve and get better. And that speaks
That's
to that
so
idea.
Weird.
I know. Well, it is weird in some ways, right? Because you think, wow, they've really been taking it on the chin in this economy for a while. Of course, if the economy in their view is really, really bad, maybe you think, well, it can't get much worse than this. So there are all these contradictions that sort of underlie what people do and say and feel in the economy every day.
Dave, we did our sort of own informal poll, if you will, asking our listeners and our online community about what keeps people up at night in terms of their financial worries. And this dovetails with the poll itself. I was surprised by the number of people who say their money worries keep them up at night.
Yeah, it's more than 1 in 4. So 28% of the people who we surveyed said their personal financial situation is causing them to lose sleep. And it gets even more interesting when you break it down by demographics. If you look at by income level, it even holds for people who are making more than $100,000. More than 1 in 6 of people who are making more than $100,000 in a year are still having trouble sleeping at night because of their finances.
Dave Shaw, our Washington Bureau Chief, thank you as always.
Thank you, Lizzie.
I mentioned in that conversation with Dave Shaw that we asked our listeners online and on the air to tell us what keeps them awake in the middle of the night. And we got a bunch of really moving responses. One particularly striking one came from Maribel Cotto in Altamonte Springs, Florida. So we're going to play you an extended conversation with her. I started by asking her to tell me what financial worries kept her up at night.
We've had money problems now for maybe 3 years, really serious. But it started pretty much affecting us maybe about 9 years ago when we started having health issues with me, breast cancer.
I'm so sorry.
And, that's fine. I mean, I'm healthy and alive today and happy that I went through that experience. Soon after that, my husband, in 2008, he had a quadruple bypass. And then the market crashed and I guess kept up at night trying to figure out how we're going to get back on our feet again like we used to be. And that has been our journey for the moment.
What goes through your head kind of when you're lying there at, 2, 3 in the morning?
How we're going to make it the next month because we're pretty much living paycheck by paycheck. If a project comes in, it's just enough to make it. And then next month we're wondering, how good are we going to be able to meet up with all our bills? That's what keeps me up at night. I mean, we almost lost our home.
Really? What happened?
My husband had a stroke last October. He miraculously, recovered from that well with no physical side effects. But it really put a toll on us because by then we were really struggling. He couldn't find employment at all. And it was just really difficult and I wasn't making enough to make ends meet. We had to get assistance. We applied for federal assistance for food. And we're still feeling the crunch, but, we're really hitting it hard. We don't want to give up, and we're just doing what we know how to do best, learning new techniques because we've had to, kind of restructure how we think, how we do our business, and how we live.
Listening to you, you sound really positive for someone who has had a lot of really hard stuff happen to them.
Well, I do feel very positive. I mean, if you hear that in my voice, that makes me feel really good. It reassures me. I mean, we support each other. We have two children. They're 18 and 15, and we've been married for 28 years now. But we've had to go on a personal journey individually where we have to see life challenges, not as a burden that'll keep us like in a hole that we think we're never going to get out of. We just have to, we appreciate that we have the opportunity to be able to do something positive for ourselves and for our children and for our lives and people that know us and that are affected by us. So we don't like to dwell on the negative, and because that's not what our life is about. And definitely one thing that we really are trying really hard to do now is just to think about saving for our future and not just living and enjoying everything that we want to have. It's just that now we really care about, do we really need this? Do we really need to go and spend money on, you know, something that we can do without? And we've cut down on a lot of things that we normally would have taken for granted in the past. I mean, I have friends that lost their homes and they've gotten sick, and, you know, it's just hard. And you can't stay feeling down. You have to really look up, because there's always something better out there. You just have to work hard and get it. It's not going to come to you.
Talking to Maribel got us thinking. A year from now, we will be in the thick of an election. So using a year as our point of reference, here's our question for next week. What financial goal do you want to meet by this time next year? Tell us on Facebook, Twitter, or our website, marketplaceweekend.org. And you can call us at 1-800-648-5114. Within Marketplace, we pride ourselves on not using business jargon, or if we do, explaining it and making it fun, which is where the idea for this segment, Long and Short, came from. Instead of stock market bets, long, stocks you are positive and betting on, short, stocks you are betting against, we do it with news stories. And this week, we've got Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent for the New York Times, and Mitra Kalita, managing editor for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
I want to start with you, Neil, because you've got sort of a Washington long for me. What are you long now this upcoming week?
You know, it's something I wouldn't have said 2 weeks ago. I'm long Paul Ryan. He became Speaker last week. He is actually inheriting a better position than I think anybody would have expected about a month ago. A month ago, it was unclear what was going to happen in the Speaker of the House race. Would he even take the job? He's now taken it. And even better, if you're Paul Ryan, John Boehner has done a lot of the hard work that's going to have to happen in the next year and change in order to keep the government running. So Paul Ryan gets to become Speaker with a clean slate, and he doesn't have to get through any of these very tough votes of corralling this wild caucus in the House Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, I think with all this stuff with like the budget deal and all these things laid out and like, okay, I will become Speaker if all of you guys line up, I think any one of the three of us could probably step in. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but we could all be Speaker of the House at this point.
Lizzie for Speaker.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Mitra, what are you long? I love this one.
Well, I moved to Los Angeles about 6 months ago and thought that the weather was a thing of my past, right? It's always beautiful here. And when I heard that IBM was buying the digital assets of the Weather Channel, I suddenly kind of sat up and took notice, because the weather hasn't really been something I've checked for most of the 6 months I've been here, but the last few weeks certainly with El Nino, and today's kind of windy. And so LA is going through this weather moment. And I thought in the transition that a lot of companies are making, right? A few years ago, I was saying everyone was becoming a tech company. And since I've moved to California, it feels like everybody wants to be a media company. That's certainly the vibe I get whenever I'm up in Silicon Valley. And I you can't help but wonder what's IBM's play here, right? It's an old tech company. And then you think about what is the conversation we're all having every day, and even here in Los Angeles, which is, what is the weather? And so I thought this was a pretty genius move as far as IBM keeping itself relevant. And then the big data play is not just on the weather, but of course, all of us who are turning to the weather and where we are and what we're
doing. Yeah, I check that app every morning.
That's right. So that's something that surprised me, and I sort of scratched my head. And then I said, given everything going on, both in my own, you know, day-to-day weather check, as well as what's happening with tech companies, I thought this was one worth keeping an eye on.
Neil, I have known you for over a decade, so I'm not going to drag your own questionable eating habits when we were in our 20s into this, but I would like you to tell me you're short.
I am short Egg McMuffins, and here's why. McDonald's has been rolling out its new all-day breakfast menu. The idea is that you can get an Egg McMuffin or another breakfast sandwich throughout the day. People have been wanting this for years and clamoring for this. It may be harder than it looked, and it may be harder to execute. We're hearing reports from franchisees, the logistical challenge of making Egg McMuffins while you're also making Quarter Pounders with cheese is actually harder than it sounds in some of these small kitchens. It also might reduce the average ticket size if people are getting a cheaper breakfast sandwich instead of a burger. So this is a situation where, you know, we'll see how it evolves. We don't have solid numbers yet from McDonald's. This may be a harder thing to do and a harder thing to pull off than they've been hoping.
Mita, let's stay on bad diets for your short.
Oh, God. I'm just thinking about Egg McMuffins and candy. Whose idea was Halloween on a Saturday? I mean, this is just, for working moms like me, we knew what we were getting. Monday through Friday, you run home from work. There's a few hours of trick-or-treaters. There's a few hours of getting your kids ready. But Halloween on a Saturday is really throwing me for a loop. First of all, it's 15 hours of candy consumption, maybe more. So just a lot of questions around Halloween on a Saturday and whether we want to put that on, I don't know, let's say more like a Thanksgiving schedule, both to curb our diets as well as manage my schedule.
I want to throw in the one thing I am long, and that is two children. Everywhere I go, everybody wants to talk about the Chinese economy. Now that China has changed its one-child policy, we're talking about two kids. What do you guys think? Can I be long two kids? Is this going to have an effect on China's slightly sputtering economy?
You know, we've been hearing about the bad demographics in China and how they may not have the kind of population growth to support strong economic growth in the future. Maybe that's about to change.
I would also say not to underestimate the societal and cultural impact here, that the one-child policy has largely been seen as draconian. Is this a loosening up of something?
Mitra Kalita from the Los Angeles Times, Neil Irwin from the New York Times. Guys, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
If you walked past a bookstore window recently and wondered what all the musician biographies are doing there, or perhaps looked at the book section of your iTunes and gotten similarly confused, you can be forgiven. Yeah, we are in the middle of a trend. And Brendan Francis Newnham is going to explain it. He is one of the hosts of the Dinner Party Download, our sister show here at 8 p.m. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, Lizzie. Thanks for inviting me along.
Of course. What is going on? What's with all these rock star books that are out there? And why do you have all these cool guests traipsing through the office recently?
Well, unfortunately, my show, we cover culture, we cover movies, we cover books, and we cover music. But lately, the books and music have been overlapping. This week, we had Carrie Brownstein of Sleater-Kinney. She was on the show. We had Elvis Costello in the other week. There's a Grace Jones biography out there. We're trying to speak with her. And what's happening is lots of musicians are publishing books. There's a market for them. And we're seeing them this time of year because people are staying inside more because it's colder and reading, and we're getting ready for the holiday season. A lot of publishers are trying to get their books in those windows or on the front of the iTunes book landing page.
Whatever that thing is. Are they any good?
You know, some of them are pretty good. Patti Smith, who has another book out now, her first book, Just Kids, is really a phenomenal book. Her new book is called M Street. It's selling well, and it is well written. Some of them aren't so good. Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth wrote a book this year that I didn't think was very good, frankly. We had Elvis Costello on this week. But, you know, sometimes it's not the writing, it's the anecdotes. Who else can tell stories like this one? My co-host Rico Galliano interviewed Elvis Costello last week, and here's a story about a little show he played when he was a young man.
I went to this festival. We played. Nobody could care less about us. the Clash played, people were throwing cans of beer at the security, and then we all ended up in a hotel room, and then this idiotic scene occurred where the other members of the Clash were teasing Joe's
drummer,
because they'd spotted that we had a very slight physical resemblance, like we could be distant cousins. And then when Joe put my glasses on, of course, that must have confirmed the suspicion that they had.
The resemblance.
They all just burst out laughing, you know. And it's such a sort of a sweet memory, really, because, you know, all the other things were all so furious. And some of it sort of trumped up.
Let's talk about the economics behind this. So if you have Elvis Costello, Patti Smith, Carrie Brownstein, whoever, are they big sellers? Do these things make a lot of money?
Well, some of them are. I think we blended a couple groups of people there. So I think the Patti Smith, she's selling books. We also have Bob Dylan wrote a book in 2004, Chronicles Volume 1. That sold a lot of books. Keith Richards, Life.
My mom was super into that one.
And your mom would be, because baby boomers buy books. And that's why we're going to continue to see books coming out from the rock icons of their era. I heard recently that Phil Collins just signed a book deal. I wonder if it will have a jacket on it.
Oh, come on. Brendan.
I just came up with that one.
Okay, fine. But Carrie Brownstein, not a baby boomer. I mean, that's more our generation's music.
That's true. So Carrie Brownstein, and as we mentioned, the Kim Gordon book, which, hey, check it out if you like Sonic Youth. A little more our generation. Millennials, too, read books.
Do they buy them?
They buy print books, yes, according to a couple of people I spoke to. Overall, what we're seeing with these musicians is something we're seeing with comedians like Amy Schumer, etc. They're buying the name. They don't have to spend money on the name recognition. It saves them a step in marketing. And for some of the big musicians, they immediately know they're going to sell a bunch. I'm sure that Phil Collins' book is going to move some units.
Does this work out bottom line for the publishing houses that spend, you know, $8-10 million on advances for somebody like Amy Schumer?
You know, there's an interesting article that just came out the other week by Alex Shepard in the New Republic where he breaks this down, and he worked in the industry, and it seems like it does. So although $10 million sounds like a huge advance, they then get a percentage of the hardcover sales, they get a percentage of the paperback sales, then they get foreign distribution rights, and at the end of the day, books don't cost that much to make. So if you're selling a book for $25 and it costs $2 to make, even after you give your piece to Amy Schumer, you're still going to have some revenue left over.
Brendan Francis Noonan, host of the Dinner Party Download, our sister show. Thank you so much for coming on.
I look forward to talking to you about Taylor Swift's cookbook in the future episode.
We're going to look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them on our website, marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan. Our first number, 1.
That's how many children Chinese couples have been allowed to have for the past 3 decades.
But on Thursday, the government announced the policy would no longer be enforced. Couples are now allowed to have 2 children.
It's part of China's attempts to handle care for its aging population.
69.
That's the percentage of shoppers who say they plan on web rooming this holiday season, according to a new study from Deloitte.
Raghu, what's web rooming?
Well, do you ever go to a store, figure out what you want to buy, and then go back home and buy it online? Mm-hmm. This is the exact opposite. You forget what you want online, you go to a store, and then you buy it so you get it faster.
14 million.
That's how many people tuned into Wednesday night's third Republican presidential debate.
Bad news for CNBC. The last 2 GOP contests broke records and attracted around 23 million viewers each.
In one of the most buzzed about moments, Senator Ted Cruz blasted the moderators for asking inane gotcha questions. That moment clocked more than 20,000 tweets per minute.
Not to brag, I think like half those tweets were mine.
Yeah, I remember you were reading them all during our morning meeting.
Still funny. Still funny the next day.
If you have ever watched the show Inside the Actor's Studio, you've probably heard the host, James Lipton, ask a relatively famous series of questions of his guests.
about their deepest desires, what they want heaven to look like, things like that. So we designed a similar series of questions, but with money as a central focus. We call it the Marketplace Quiz, and this week our quiz guest is writer, director, and artist Miranda July. And we got a little questioning assistance from some people on the street in Washington, D.C.
Hi, I'm Miranda July, and I'm a writer, director, and artist.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
food? obviously, let's see. Can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you time and like a certain amount of freedom, which can make you happy. So it can. It can buy you happiness, in fact.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
Well, I mean, the thing is, though we badmouth the elliptical trainer, there are pockets of time where it's the only way to exercise. And so, you know, just as I'm always about to, like, pay someone to take it out of our lives, I'll have, like, you know, a 2-week or maybe even 2-day run on it, so to speak. And I'll be like, no, this thing is great. It's great for your butt.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
I guess just that it is hard. Like, I think there's sometimes a misconception with art and creative practices that it's just sort of all intuitive or just make it all up as you go along. Especially women, I think, that often is seen as a happy accident when, I remember with my first movie, people asked me, like, did you just make it up as you went along? And I was like, no, I wrote a script and I worked really hard and it was hard work. So I think just that it's hard for my profession.
What is something everyone should own, no matter what the cost?
Healthy food. I mean, that's such a mom answer. I just feel like, in a political sense, I feel like everyone is entitled to that, and things that make that harder or kind of lure you away from that or seem to be easier are really like a crime. It's like, well, what you have ultimately is your body, and I still think every time I go grocery shopping, I think, oh, I get to have anything I want, which I remember a long time where that wasn't true, you know? You walk in and you're, like, very careful about each purchase. And now that's, like, in a way the richest I feel. Like, how much damage could I do buying, like, the good quinoa? It's, like, only going to be a couple dollars more. It's not going to break the bank. But that still gives me, like, a really safe feeling.
In a next life, what would your career be?
Oh, that's hard because I pretty much just add on to this one every time I think of something. I kind of wish I could play piano or sing. Like, there's certain arts that I don't do that, of course, seem like the truly liberating ones. And just to be able to, like, open your mouth and sing or, like, lose yourself. Sometimes my son tells me to play piano we have a little keyboard, while he's, like, playing, and so I'm sort of just forced to do it, and I've gotten better starting from, like, zero, to the point where I now try and get people to listen and just sort of determine whether I might be a genius at this, and everyone's like, no, not at all.
When did you realize art could be a career?
I think I always thought of it as a career. And this comes from the fact that I grew up in a business. My parents ran their publishing company out of our house. So I had much more a sense of a business and that being real than like a art career. So even the very first things I made, like a play that I put on, I was like more involved in the like mimeographed pamphlet for the play than the play itself, you know, like the materials and everything that makes something professional were always important to me long before that became like appropriate in any way. It was sort of cute, and then it was like arrogant, and then finally it was sort of had its place.
Miranda July's new book, The First Bad Man, is out now in paperback. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
You've probably heard of wearables like Fitbit or the ill-fated Google Glass, but now there's a whole new wave of them being created in labs, basically taking electronics and putting them into tattoo-like pieces of adhesive, and then you can stick them on your skin. That's what's happening in Nanshu Liu's lab. She's an assistant professor at the University of Texas in Austin. Liu and her team hope that what are called epidermal electronics could lead to medical breakthroughs, but she warns that we're still a little bit away from seeing them in everyday life.
There are several challenges. One of them is the one that we're trying to tackle in our recent work, is that how do we find a way to manufacture those tattoo-like or epidermal electronics in a more affordable and a more disposable manner?
These devices, they're printable, disposable, they're wearables, and they're really at the cutting edge, which means they are not widely available yet, even to us, but we're starting to see how these things might work once they go from the lab to the pharmacy. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life, and he's here to talk about them with us. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Lizzie.
So I want to get back to the cutting edge stuff in a second, but can you give me kind of a bigger view of the wearable market? We've talked about this a little bit on the show.
Absolutely. Now, forecasts put the wearable market reaching at around $25 billion in the next 5 years.
$25 billion a year?
$25 billion a year. Now, this is, of course, a very optimistic outlook.
Okay.
And we are seeing a lot of growth in wearables, but they have a couple of big problems right now. Consumers aren't yet sure what they're really good for, necessarily. You, I'm sure, have heard or talked to people who bought an Apple Watch and then returned it, or bought another smartwatch made by someone else, an Android watch maybe and returned it, or a Fitbit. A lot of people are buying these things, buying Fitbits, other bands, using them for 3 weeks and then actually putting them down. The problem is really twofold. On the one hand, it's about convincing me that I need something to tell me my heart rate 24/7. And as a regular consumer, I'm not yet necessarily convinced. There's some sort of health tracking gamification that people can get into, and they do, but it's not clear how wide that will become yet.
And the other problem is the hardware involved, right?
Exactly, Lizzie. You have to charge it. You have to buy it for between $100 and $600,
not which cheap.
Is not cheap if it's like a new thing that you're not quite sure how it's going to improve your life. The technology can get outdated, just like any other device, but we're getting a lot better at miniaturizing this stuff.
Not sure that's a word, but go ahead.
We're getting better basically at making the computing power that we're putting into wearables more efficient, smaller, etc. And the key point here is also cheaper.
Okay, so that's where people like Nanshu Liu come in.
Yes. Making wearables that are almost low tech, very cheap to make, simple manufacturing processes. They do single functions. This kind of thing could be a more realistic and more useful future for parts of the healthcare industry. A lot of really important health monitoring is temporary. Maybe you have a young child and you want to monitor their temperature while they have the flu, or maybe you have some other illness that requires a certain kind of health monitoring, but then you don't need it anymore. So think of a pill, Lizzie, right?
Okay.
With a casing that dissolves in your stomach. That is a technological solution to a healthcare problem of medicine release.
Whoa. So you're not just talking about like the tattoo aspect of this. You're talking about a thing that goes inside of me, not just paste it on.
Yes. If we're looking at the next level wearable, Lizzie, we're actually looking at embeddables, the piece of technology that actually goes inside you and either composts or disappears or passes through your system, shall we say, can potentially do a lot for patients. And that's not going to do as much for consumer tech companies, which
on the money end, right?
On the money end. But it could be a huge potential win and change in the healthcare industry. And that's why a lot of researchers are playing with this idea.
Wow. Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
$34 million is a fair amount of money. And that's how much several companies avoided paying in payroll taxes in San Francisco last year, thanks to a tax break devised to lure them into the city. That story is one that you, our listeners, pointed out to us through our Local Money Project. It's also a story about development, gentrification, and tech. To talk about it, we've got John King. He's the urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell me about these tax deals that were brokered with tech companies, specifically in this neighborhood. What's it called? Mid-Market?
Yes. Market Street is kind of symbolically the most important street in San Francisco. Mid-Market refers to the blocks kind of west of the Union Square area. And no matter how much the rest of Market Street has prospered in the last 30 or 40 years, Mid-Market always really languished. It had lots of empty buildings. It had lots of kind of rundown derelict buildings with rundown derelict tenants. It was really kind of the place that blight was not going to go away from. And no matter how much the rest of downtown San Francisco has prospered in recent decades, Mid-Market was always the nut no one could crack. And it just got kind of more moribund and more derelict as things around it seemed to prosper and grow and get higher and glitzier and, you know, more varied. And there have been redevelopment plans for it that never got approved. There have been economic initiatives that fell short. Lots of big talk that went nowhere. And what you saw were more and more buildings just being emptied out entirely. And so the current mayor, Ed Lee, around 2011, 2012, agreed to a tax break that would waive payroll taxes beyond a certain point, newly created payroll taxes, for companies that set up in the Mid-Market area. And it was really, it instantly became known as the Twitter tax break. And it was really kind of designed with Twitter in mind, which is, this is a company that's not public. It's going to go public. When it does go public, lots of people are going to be getting a lot of money. They don't all want to be hit with extra payroll taxes or the...
Because at the time they would have... I guess, what, stock options in the way they were paid
exactly,
because the company hadn't gone, hadn't so gone got, public then. Aha.
Right. So you've got the stock options that are going to kick in. Everybody could see it coming. And this company was saying, and other companies like it were saying, why do we want to locate in San Francisco? If you're going to grab a big piece of this, we can just go down to the peninsula where that type of payroll tax is not in place. Now Mid-Market is teeming with life. All these big old buildings that were empty are virtually uninhabited or only uninhabited by government agencies paying dirt cheap rent are filling up with the likes of Twitter, with Uber, with Dolby Laboratories, with Zendex. You've got all these big companies in buildings that, and this is a fluke of development patterns, you know, the Twitter building, the building. It's 1355 Market. Everyone thinks of it as the Twitter building. That is an entire block along Market Street. It is enormous.
So I guess you could say, you know, from the argument that the city was trying to make in terms of bringing in growth and activity, from their standpoint, it worked, right?
It has worked very well. And you have critics on the left who have kind of come after it in recent years because of the larger social and cultural changes going on in San Francisco as a whole, just kind of the heat of the hyperboom and everything. And so this is part of it. But the fact is, these buildings had resisted any sort of activity. So maybe these companies would have moved in even without it. But in defense of Mayor Lee and a lot of economists, the past evidence didn't suggest that would happen.
You have studied the city for a long time, written two books about it. You know, when you walk through the neighborhood now, mm-hmm. what does it look like? What does it feel like?
It is a very strange place right now. Mid-Market, from 5th to 12th roughly, it is seven long blocks between Union Square and the Civic Center, City Hall and things like that. And up until about 18 months ago, if you walked down it, you saw kind of real kind of nasty grifter types. You saw lots of down on their luck type of people just like, you know, leaning against empty storefronts and things like that. And you saw kind of regular, quote unquote, regular business people scurrying from point A to point B. I mean, it was really just like kind of this weird half empty landscape. And now what you have are, you know, I'm just going to caricature, you know, kind of the techie type person who's walking, you know, with their chai in their hand, zipping over to the Twitter offices or to the Uber offices or something like that. This incredible economic disparity. I'm an architecture critic. One of my favorite buildings is this old furniture store. It's about six stories high with four story high columns above the base and glass in the middle. You know, the thing was a sweatshop for decades, and it got fixed up about 2 years ago. There's a company, Zendex, is in there, which actually does not take advantage of the tax break. They chose not to. And the bottom floor is now a chai bar. I mean, the change in that building the last 3 years is the change in Market Street.
John King, urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you.
You're welcome. It was fun to be here.
Tell us what money story is a big deal where you live. Go to our website, marketplaceweekend.org, and click on Local Money. People like to misquote Fitzgerald a lot and say there are no second acts in American lives. That's not really what he meant. He went on to say that there are. And in fact, our next story is about the second act of a singer who got really famous in the 90s with one song that you will absolutely remember, even its first few chords. Adrian Hill, who covers entertainment for us, has that story. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie. So I want to start, Lizzie, with this snippet from our early adulthood. Sing with me, Lizzie.
You'll hear what I want to.
Do you remember it?
Oh, God. Yeah, you're taking me back to wearing Doc Martens and maybe a baby doll dress. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, wow. Mm-hmm.
I know. So now we're all in that sort of vaguely wistful, kind of glad we're not that age anymore mood. I recently sat down with Lisa Loeb here in Los Angeles to talk to her about her transition into kids' music. But first, I just had to ask her about Stay.
When I go on the road and I play either in the United States or in other places in the world, people of all ages have memories of that song.
And, you know, talking to her about it, she seems fine with it. Like, it's okay that it's her legacy.
Yeah, I have to admit, that song I associate with dating a lot of kind of loser slackers in my early 20s. So sorry, Lisa Loeb, I'm blaming you for that. But okay, she has a new venture now. Tell me about that.
You know, she's been doing this for a while. She got started when Barnes & Noble came to her and offered her a deal. Now she's got this new album out on Amazon. It's called Nursery Rhyme Parade. And it's one of those ventures of Amazon where it's original music for them and for Prime subscribers. So it's an interesting thing. She told me, though, that she wanted to do kids' music from the very beginning.
And I had always wanted to make a kid's record. Ever since I was a kid, in the mid to late 70s, there was a lot of grown-up and kid entertainment. Like, it was hard to see where it was. Was it for kids or for grown-ups? And so I always wanted to make a kid's record.
This old man, he played one. He played knick-knack on my thumb with a knick-knack paddywhack. Give the dog a bone. This old man came rolling home.
What's it like being a kid's recording artist? How does that compare to recording for adults?
Recording kids' music has really informed my work as a grown-up record maker. You know, making kids' records has really made me realize that there's so much that connects with people, whether they're young or old, when you do something very immediate, when you're able to go in and just sing the song. Not sing it 2,000 times and fix it and make it perfect, but just sing the song in a way that relates the song to a listener. So it's really the same, the kind of music I make for kids and grownups. And I think that that's important, too, because that makes music that lasts forever.
Is the industry itself any different on the kids' side versus the adult side? Are there secret backstabbers in kids' music industry?
I don't know. I found that the kids' music world, there's a whole kids' Grammys organization. There are organizations on Facebook, people who make kids' music. As we all know, there's lots and lots of grown-up artists who are jumping into the field of making kids' music. We have kids. It's fun. It's fun to do. It's a little bit different. It just feels fresher because I think I haven't been doing kids' music for as long, even though I've been doing it for, gosh, almost 10 years now.
Wow. What's it feel like to get up in front of a crowd full of dancing 3 and 4 and 5 and 6-year-olds?
Playing in front of that many dancing children is kind of like playing for a bunch of drunk grown-ups. I remember when my song Stay got on the radio, and I'd play a lot of radio festivals, and people just wanted to hear the one song from each artist that they knew. And it was the backwards baseball caps and way too much beer from a keg and a lot of talking during the real other songs. With kids, I've gotten used to it. You know, there are moments when kids get really excited and they get up and dance, and I've learned to interpret what success means. You know, I see kids, they get up and they start dancing around and they run up to the stage, and it's really fun. I think it used to make me a little nervous, like, oh my gosh, they're not listening. They should sit down and listen. But now I realize we're really engaging in a communication. You know, it makes each show different from the next. And again, to see them do Itsy Bitsy Spider with their own hands, that kind of participation is thrilling for me. I really enjoy it.
The Itsy Bitsy Spider up the water spout, down came the rain and washed the spider out.
So lots of people know who you are. What's one thing you wish they knew about you that they don't?
People stop me on the street all the time. I wear glasses and people say, oh, I know you. You're Lisa Loeb. You've got those glasses. And I even have an eyewear line now. But I wish all those people who knew me for my glasses, they would actually buy records as well. People have really fallen out of purchasing music. You need that support, you know, to have people actually listen to the music and to connect with you in that way really means a lot to me.
That's amazing. So she's sort of an entrepreneur, I guess, in two different kinds of businesses.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that really struck me talking to her is just this is an artist who had this great success really early in her career, and it's success that's paved the way for her to do lots of other things, but she still has to hustle. She still has to go out there, and it's so difficult to make a living as a musician these days. So she does have an eyewear line. She also has something else going for her, which is that the 90s are coming back in fashion a little bit, and so shows like The New Muppet Show.
I have mixed feelings about that.
Yes. Don't we all? But, you know, The New Muppet Show recently licensed Stay, and sort of Stay is getting airtime again, and she's making some money off of that. So it's good for her. Whether or not we like it, it's good for her. The 90s are coming back.
Marketplace's entertainment correspondent, Adrian Hill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we want to know, what financial goal do you want to have knocked off your list by this time next year? Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Jenny Amond. Golda Arthur is our senior producer this week, and Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Nara Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.